Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Hello, this is William Finks with Pastor Eli James. Eli's away tonight at an affair. He had a chance to present a message to some people, and I'll be filling in. It's December 19th, Saturday, Yahweh's Covenant People, and I have Clifton M. Heiser here. How you doing, Clifton?
Well, I'm doing pretty good. I've read up on the subject of the Crusaders all week, and I read sometimes to the place where my eyes went out of focus, and then I had to rest them and go back at it again. So, you know, I've done a lot of reading on it.
Great. So what are we going to talk about? We're going to start with how you got into this topic.
Yeah, right. It's kind of one of those roundabout things, you know, that I had a little small booklet, you know, not very, about 10 pages and not very big, that was put out by, what's his name now? Any other time I'd remember his name. William Blessing.
Okay, I've heard the name, but I don't
really
know.
Now, William Blessing, he got some things right, you know. But if anybody's listening, you know, William Blessing was kind of a follower of universalism, you know, and he took that passage in Isaiah there, you know, church of all for all people, you know, and he took that out of context, and he's trying to bring all the races in, you know. An example of some of the things he got mixed up on. He actually thought the world was square or a cube, you know.
Well, they take that four corners of the earth awfully literally at times, don't they?
Well, he really took it literally, and his answer to that was, if you took a cube and you spinned it fast enough, it would look round. I thought that was, that was a strange reaction.
Yeah, that's just pretty crazy.
Well, you could spin it as fast as you want to, it'd stay a cube.
It's still a cube, right. And Isaiah clearly talked about the circle of the earth.
It's just an example how you can take things wrong, and but otherwise on the tribes and stuff, he did pretty good, and he understood some of the basic things we shouldn't understand in identity. And one time I got his material, must be 20 years ago now, and the Christian Crusade Church in Louisiana, they advertised that, you know, that he had died, and that his wife was selling off all his materials, you know, how they'd have to do to get rid of a lot of the stuff that way, and said if you'd send a small offering and they told where to send it, that they'd send you a package, you know. And I had no idea how much I'd get, you know, and here one day a pretty good sized box comes through the mail and a whole bunch of stuff, and I've never looked into it real deeply, but what I've been kind of, you know, holding it for is if I need to address different subjects where a guy's going wrong on, you know, which I do a lot, I could use him, I could use some of his arguments like that cube business. Write a paper, but anyway, this paper that I started to write on him, and I wanted to follow his outline, and he called it the Israel Truth. Well, it was a good title, and he stuck to it pretty well, but I didn't want to use the same title, so I thought I would call it something like the Israel Truth versus the Gentile Lie, or the Gentile Lie versus the Israel Truth, or something like that. And besides, I thought that if I called it the Israel Truth, people would turn it off. You know, they wouldn't read it. So, you know, you got to pick out a title that a lot of these people will take the time to at least read a couple paragraphs. And so what I decided on was a misapplication of the biblical term Gentile, which is not, it's not actually a biblical term unless you
unless you count Jerome as
the Bible. Yes, you count Jerome, and of course I went into that, and I did. I spent quite a bit of time checking up on the word Gentile again.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, this might sound crazy, but sometimes, and I told Eli this a few weeks ago, I think we should embrace the word Gentile because it means an adjective describing people of the same race, right?
Yeah.
So we should embrace the word that the gospel went to the people of the same race. But we could never, I don't think we could ever get the definition of the word straight in the average Christian, you know, in the average Christian mind.
But I, you know, I've got a lot of commentaries and Bible dictionaries and lexicons and all that kind of stuff. And I did, I started going through those, you know, one at a time, and I can't say for sure, but I'm certain that I can't find any place where any of those commentaries explains that Gentile is a Latin word. And for the first time I went to, I never looked it up in Strong's before, but I knew that he goes by the King James Word, so the King James Word was Gentile. So I looked in that section to get the number, and then I went to the Greek dictionary in the Strong's to the right number, and of course it came up with ethnos like it should, but he never he called it Gentile in one place. And then he used a Greek word in the other, and he didn't explain. You know, he could have saved a lot of trouble if he'd have explained that Gentile was a Latin term.
Probably, but no, they don't want to go there for some reason. They want to give it the false meaning that the mainstream churches give it today.
Yeah,
and they really don't want to explain it. And in all honesty, it doesn't belong in the biblical New Testament language at all.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, the Greek word is ethnos, and an ethnos is a nation.
Well, you know, that's one of the first things I stated that none of the Bible writers ever used the word Gentile.
Right.
The Latin word Gentile. It's not in the Hebrew. It's not in the Aramaic. It's not in the Greek.
No, it's a Latin word.
Yeah. And so it's not actually a biblical term, only if you include Jerome. But anyway, the only place I could really find, and I did find something new on it that I didn't know before, I went to the American Heritage Dictionary, and I know you've got a copy. Yours may not be the same year as mine, but it's probably pretty much the same. And it did get what I discovered, it had two, which the other dictionaries don't have. It had two definitions for Gentile, and one they capitalized, and the other they didn't. Now, in all the other dictionaries, they capitalized Gentile, and so under the two, a Gentile with the lowercase, you know, not capitalized. Of course, it has of pertaining to the gens, or to the tribal society based on it, and then has a noun usage here. Number one, the number of a gens. And then it tells you it comes, which they do, which a lot of them don't give, the dictionaries don't give you the origin, and it says Latin gentilis from gens, clan, and then it has gens in, small caps, and that wasn't the entire, but I just put in the paper what they need to know, And I used eclipses, a couple eclipses there to leave out some stuff. And then I figure it was, you have to go to the word gens and get the definition on that. So I did that, and I typed it all out, and I have to use all these spatial fonts that, you know, that's pretty difficult to do. But on gens, you know, number one, the particular clan forming the basic unit of the Roman tribe and having originality, a common name, land, cult, and burial ground, and two, anthropological and exogamous par trinere. It has to do with it means near patriotic and patron. Oh, I can't pronounce it. Patrilinear clan.
Patrilinear.
Patrilinear,
meaning descending, you know, lineally from a.
I knew the definition of, but I couldn't pronounce it. And then it tells you to go to the appendix. It has in brackets Latin and gens clan, C G E N E dash in the appendix. So.
Well, that's the word, you know, that's gene. I think it's almost providential that Jerome, translating the Greek into the Vulgate, he somehow had to know that the gospel message was for people related to the Israelites.
Well, I believe that the word Gentile would be all right if you was translating it into making a Latin Bible, which he did.
Right.
And so I don't see anything out of place.
If he was going to refer, you know, he took this Greek word ethnos, which means a nation or a tribe, and we get ethnicity from it. And he had a choice, he had a wide choice of words to translate it into in Latin. Nadio, terra, if he just wanted to indicate other countries, or civitas, if he wanted to indicate people of other nationalities, or natio, not natio, is a nation, but he chose gentilis, and that means somebody who's related, you know, the medieval English, the English translators of the Vulgate and the English translators of the King James may not have understood it that way when they brought the word gentilis as Gentile into the English language. They may not have understood it that way. In fact, I'm sure that they didn't. But it's odd that Jerome used that word. He had a handful of words to select from. And he chose that word.
Yeah, you're right. And then I went to the appendix under G-E-N-E hyphen, and then it says in the appendix also G-E-N hyphen. So if it's whether it's G-E-N-E hyphen or G-E-N hyphen, the definition is it's the Indo-European definition of it, to give birth, beget, with derivatives referring to aspects and results of procreation, and to, is that word familial?
Right. Well, gens, the Roman word, the Latin word gens, is directly related to the Greek word genos, from which we get genus, which means race. There's no doubt.
But I, what I found out in all this was that they had a second Gentile with a capital G, and I found out that this definition with the capital G, which everybody uses, didn't exist until
until the Schofield
middle,
Bible.
the Middle English. Now, when Jerome was translating, the word gentilis was under the late Latin period, and the late Latin period was about 150 to 700 A.D.
Right. Jerome translated his Vulgate around 420 A.D. or thereabouts.
Yeah, whereas the Middle English period, which the capital G Gentile comes under, was from 1150 to 1475 A.D., and what happened between those two periods, the definition changed. And so they've got a second definition in this dictionary, which I think they did a good job. They give you two different things on it. I thought that was good. And then, under the capital G, they have anyone who is not of the Jewish faith or is of non-Jewish nation, two, a Christian as distinguished from a Jew, three, a pagan or heathen, four, among Mormons, a person who is not a Mormon, and so on. And see, you can see that the definition under the late Latin period is entirely different from the term Gentile under the Middle English.
Well, it seems like the church used the definition to its advantage.
Well, somebody started using that term in a different manner than it was originally meant.
Right.
And so over a period of years, you know, we're probably talking about 700 or 1,000 years, the term gradually was corrupted to a corrupt meaning. That was no longer the Latin meaning of the word. You can go to a lexicon in the Latin and go to gentilis, and it will not give you the meaning of gentilis as meaning a non-Jew. It's not there.
No, of course it's not there. That's not what the word means.
But the reason I'm bringing it up, and I wanted to write a paper on that, was to further make this damnable word Gentile. It's a curse on us.
Oh, it's a curse. It's caused a lot of confusion. But the bottom line is that Yahweh told us that His servants would be blind, and His people would be hidden, and if everything was absolutely clear, that would have never been possible. And the Jews have never claimed to be. Yeah, you know, they've always claimed to be who they think they are, and that proves that they're not those people.
Right.
You know, the scripture proves that the Jews are not Judah or Israel simply because they've never forgotten who they were.
Yeah, I wanted to make it clear in this paper to start with that you couldn't apply the word that Paul, in other words, Paul never went to so-called non-Jews.
No, it's, you know, anybody that really reads Romans chapter 4 in the Greek, Paul makes it absolutely clear, and he makes it clear in 1 Corinthians 10 and Galatians chapter 4 and many other places, but especially in Romans 4, he makes it absolutely clear that the faith of Abraham was the belief that his offspring, his seed from out of his loins, would become many nations. And Paul was clearly telling the Romans that Abraham was their forefather and they were one of those nations. And the bottom line is that Christians don't read the Bible. And when they do, they read a verse at a time and use Kabbalistic or Talmudic philosophies to interpret each verse in isolation from the other verses.
Yeah.
I can't, you know, there's no other explanation.
Well, it goes a little bit farther than that, and I brought up the fact that we are called the hidden ones, you know, and that is found in Psalm 83, 2 and 3, and of course, keep thou silence, O God, hold not thy peace, and be not still, O God, for lo, thine enemies make a tumult, they that hate thee have lifted up the head. They have taken crafty counsel against the people and consulted against the hidden ones. They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may not be no more in remembrance. And, of course, we know that that's what the enemy is doing today. But it's the fact that we're hidden. And then I go into the fact that when the Almighty hides something, that we can't even find ourselves.
Yeah, and that's absolutely the case.
He's hidden us so well that we can't even find ourselves. And I really believe that the only people that are waking up to this are people that the Almighty wants to awaken at the present time.
Well, that's absolutely true.
You could talk yourself blue in the face to some of these people, and if it isn't time for them to understand, they're just going to look at you with a blank stare.
And for that reason, I believe that we're going to stay small in number. I mean, we've grown incrementally, but it's still a drop in the ocean compared to the people that believe the lie.
But hopefully, you know, when I put this paper out, you know, and then because once I explain what the word Gentile means, then I have to reinforce it going through the various deportations, you know. And there's something that I should bring up is because there's still people that don't know all the deportations, and they will make the general statement that Israel went into Assyrian captivity and that Judah went into Babylonian captivity, and that's really not the truth. And of course I won't get into that, but that's going to be part of the paper. And then of course,
well, right. And you know, I've seen a lot of identity pastors that actually thought, you know, knowing that Paul was telling the Greeks that they're Israelites, actually thought the Greeks and the Romans were children of the deportations, and they're not. That they don't, you know, they don't understand the earlier history and the earlier dispersions of Israel.
Well, I have to admit, for a long time, I really didn't know for sure who the Romans were, but when I got into the studying the Trojans, you know, and then found out that the Trojans were descendants of Zerah-Judah, then I began to see that a good share of the Trojans are of Zerah-Judah, and of course, you know, they're the red thread people. And you remember I sent you a thing of one of the standards of the Roman legions, and one of them has the hand on it, you know. Of course, it's out of the old 1910 Encyclopedia Britannica, and of course it's not in color, but you can just know that one of those legions had a red hand on it.
Right, and a lot of the Greek and Roman symbology, the symbols they use, goes right back to the children of Israel, the same symbols.
Yeah. Now, there again, we can't say that every case that they've got these symbols right and that you can identify a certain family to a certain tribe.
No, because some families picked up symbols from the surrounding families along the way, there's no doubt.
If a person really wants to trace to see where they're from, they should take, that's one of the factors you should take in. But it's like when you get into the Scottish, you know, there's a book out showing all the families, and each Scottish clan had a different plaid. And so there's another thing you can look into, and there's various things that you can look into like that to kind of.
And let me tell you something, the more colors in that plaid, the higher up in rank one was.
Well, you know, I think that Joseph had a coat of many colors.
Well, right.
And I don't be willing to bet that was a plaid.
Right, and in the ancient world, custom dictated what people wore. Custom dictated what people wore. In Rome, for instance, you couldn't walk around in any color togi you wanted to. If you were a common man, you had a white toga, and that was it, period.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You couldn't wear a purple toga because you felt like it.
In other words, if we could jump in our time machine and went back to that time period, we better be careful what kind of clothes we take with us on the trip, wouldn't we?
Right. And that multicolored coat of Joseph's is definitely indicated that Jacob was elevating Joseph in rank. And people, the station of life that people had dictated what colors or how many colors or the colorful clothes that they wore. And an average common man wouldn't be able to walk around in blue or purple or red or any crazy colors like that.
Well, anyway, I finally ended up by reinforcing my argument that, you see, there's, and I've heard, I hear them on television occasionally, and they'll say, well, all the tribes, made it back to, Palestine by the time of Christ. And they'll use all kinds of arguments to try to show that. And the Almighty says that I'm not going to leave them come back. Now, I've got that in here someplace. Let me see here. Oh, it's Hosea 2:6. Therefore, behold, I will hedge up thy way with thorns and make a wall that she shall not find her path. That means her path back to Palestine. And when those crusaders were heading back to Palestine, they could only expect to get bloodied up real good from that hedge. And so
right. After the deportation, Yahweh put a hedge between them. There's no doubt.
And I believe that there's a lot of people that read that and never realize what it means.
Yeah, you're reading Hosea 2:6?
Just a second here. It's Hosea 2:6, unless I got it marked wrong here.
Okay, no, I have Hosea 2:6. That's what I was going to read.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You didn't bring it up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yes. And, you know, they did actually return, but the return failed. They didn't stay. You know, Herodotus wrote that the Scythians ruled Asia for 28 years. And if you observe the chronology in Herodotus, they ruled Asia at the same time that Nineveh was destroyed by Scythians and Medes. That's when it was during that 28-year period that they had ruled Asia. And they had actually come down and raided the coast of Palestine at one point. And this is about 120, 130 years after the first deportations of the Israelites. And actually, Jerusalem is still there. The Judahites are still in Jerusalem. But they came down and they raided the coast and they didn't stay. They left and they pillaged some temples and they left. And in northern Galilee, the Scythians had founded a little town, or it was really like a village called Scythopolis.
Yeah, Scythopolis. There was a Comper Ray tells about that, I think, in his Revelation series.
Right, but it wasn't a long-lasting settlement, and
right.
They were gone. I mean, a couple of hundred years later, Scythopolis is mentioned in the Greek writings in some of them, but there's no talk of Scythians actually being.
And I think there's still a place on the map, you know, over there that they still call Scythopolis.
If I'm not mistaken, I think the Hebrew name of the nearest Hebrew name is Beth Sheen.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, I think it's Beth Sheen or something very similar to that.
Well, you see, one of the biggest problems with the Crusaders was, see, you have to stop and see what history was at that time. And what I mean, Mohammedanism under the Turks, I mean, they really covered, all the way from India to Gibraltar. I mean, they and all around the Mediterranean Sea there, and that shut off the shipping through the Mediterranean, and the countries up in Europe, they had to revert to and go up and down rivers to get from one place to another. And of course, the British would have had a certain amount of freedom, but they had that Mediterranean all tied up. And your first crusaders, they didn't go jump in ships to go over there because they didn't. There was nobody that was in the shipping business that would take them there.
And no, so in fact, the later crusades, when they did take ships, they had paid the Venetians to give them the transport.
Well, see, it began to open up, but that's one thing positive about the crusades was they did start opening up the water routes on the Mediterranean. But see, those first crusaders, they had to go by land. And see, it's a problem of logistics. You know, you got a pope that wants to do big things, and you get a couple fast-talking priests that go around and get everybody worked up, and you get a lot of people that jump in and take an oath that they'll go and free Jerusalem and all that, and kick the what they was calling the Turks infidels, and the Turks was calling us infidels, it's like today we're halfway around the world and we're going over there you know, in the Middle East there, and you have to have ships, and you have to have places of storage of food and all the war implements, and all that has to be feeding in there. And today they have to plan for these things 15, 20 years ahead. Even today they don't start a war unless they planned it, you know, 15, 20 years before. And back there, they didn't make any provisions at all. All they did was get everybody excited, and they'd go grab a sword and maybe a few extra clothes in a bag that they could take along, pack a few sandwiches, and get on the road and start walking by land all the way to Jerusalem. And they had a half a million people to do that. You take, in those days, you know, those little cow paths or whatever, you know, what they called roads and stuff, probably had all kinds of ruts in them. You know, you can imagine what they looked like, although the Romans did build some pretty good roads.
Well, that's because when the Roman soldiers weren't fighting, they were building roads.
Yeah.
And aqueducts. They were working on public works projects.
Can you imagine half a million? Can you imagine a city of 500,000 people, all of them getting out and walking down the road to the next town? You know, that's a lot of people.
Absolutely.
And of course, some of them had horses and different things, you know. They weren't all walking, some of them riding horses. What they did do, they divided up in fourths so that they wouldn't, you lived in another town there and they're defending themselves and they see a bunch of people coming and they got swords and everything. Well, they're going to get out there and defend themselves. So that's what you had at the beginning of the Crusades, and they didn't plan anything ahead, the thing of it is, and when they did finally get down there and secure it, they didn't. It's like we have to send troops over there to the Middle East. Like they just recently sent a bunch more, you know. Well, if you're going to occupy a place like that, that's what it takes. It's a continuous thing, and you don't dare back down. And once the Crusaders would get a foothold in Jerusalem there, well, a lot of them would come home. Then the Turks would take the place back over again.
Well, the Abbasid Empire of the Muslims, it dissolved in the 10th century, in the 900s. And the whole Muslim world dissolved into petty factions and petty sheikdoms.
Yeah, I was reading that in the data that you sent me there.
And that basically opened the way for the Crusaders because they did not meet a common Arab resistance. In other words, if they knock one or two petty sheikdoms, petty sheiks out of the way, the surrounding ones really don't care too much about it. They're not going to rally to their defense because they don't have a common interest anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And Islam sort of broke up, you know, just like Protestantism, into a whole bunch of different factions real soon. I mean, there are Shiite Muslims and Sunni Muslims, but there are several other factions of Muslims that are less prominent today, as Sufites and things like that, Sufis, that at that time were more prominent. They had more factions at that time than just as many that American or European Protestantism had. So they weren't all united and loving each other either.
Right. The Crusaders, they didn't wait till they got all the way to Jerusalem to start getting rid of the infidels. Ridpath and his world history, in the second volume on page 304, he says this, quote, "The result was as revolting as the beginning was abominable. The superstitious horde fell upon the Jewish colonists in the cities of the Rhine and the Moselle," I guess that's another river, M-O-S-E-L-L-E,
yes,
"and began to rob and murder. The victims of the atrocity had, under the protection of the barons of the towns, become prosperous and wealthy. The circumstance whetted the appetite of the vile rabbi who pretended to see in the Jews only the enemies of Christ." They that's something I didn't get right there. They proposed to begin the holy war by exterminating the foes of God in Europe before proceeding against those in Asia. You want to say something?
Yeah. Let me. You know, I have two sources here, and I know that before the First Crusade actually got off to Palestine, that they had stopped in Frankfurt and wiped out a lot of Jews. That they basically slaughtered, looted, and pillaged a lot of Jews in Frankfurt, Germany, which is it's one of the biggest cities in the Rhine, in the Rhineland. Now, I have a world almanac from, let me see what year, 2005. And this is, it's nothing, you know, it's not a real history book. They got a little section on world history. It's nothing I would really cite as an important source for history. But they have in this, under the Crusades, that basically Jews were massacred or expelled and wars were launched against Christian heretics. And it gives three expulsions of the Jews from the Rhineland, from France, from the Rhineland, from France. I'm looking for it. And in 1096, the Jews were expelled from the Rhineland. I still can't find the exact thing that I want.
I don't see it.
1096 from the Rhineland, 1290 from England, and 1306 from France. Jews were massacred or expelled, and wars were launched against Christian heretics, meaning, you know, the Albigensians,
right,
and the Waldenses in France. Well, this admits, this World Almanac admits basically that there were pogroms against Jews at the First Crusade in the Rhineland in 1096.
Yeah, that
now,
would
now
be
the first crusade.
Right, no.
That the first crusade really didn't get to do anything. You know, it took them 2 years to get to Palestine, okay, or to Anatolia, and 3 years to get to Palestine. And I'll get into that in a minute. But, you know, I have this Encyclopedia of World History here, and it's voluminous. It's like over 1,000 pages, and it's very tiny print, and it's supposed to be an overview of all – it's 1,200 pages. It's supposed to be an overview, a basic sketch of all world history from, I mean, it goes back into the earliest, you know, into the Paleolithic era and talks about dinosaurs. But while that doesn't – this voluminous book of world history – has not one mention of the pogrom against the Jews in the Rhineland during the First Crusade. Why would they want to keep that quiet?
Well, it's obvious that
there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of history that's well known that I've read in other sources about the pogroms against Jews and how the Jews were expelled from you know, just about every country in Europe at one time or another. But there's hardly a mention of any of that in this politically correct, washed-up Encyclopedia of World History. It's crazy. The book looks so authoritative. It's published by Houghton Mifflin, 2001, and it's a nice book, and they spent a lot of money putting it together, and it's toilet paper. It's worthless. It's incredible.
Well, Ridpath here, he calls them Israelites, and of course I put in parentheses, thick, you know, Canaanite Jews.
Yeah, he didn't know any better. That's the way it is. But it's amazing how a trashy source like the World Almanac can mention these pogroms of the Jews during the Crusades, and this supposedly scholarly source I have here, this Encyclopedia of World History, it just hides the whole thing.
Well, I should mention that the famous John Hagee, you know, he cited the instance of the Crusaders persecuting the Jews, you know, and on one of his programs, and he said that they surrounded their synagogue and set it on fire. And that they were singing hymns while the Jews were burning inside. And I thought, good for them.
Yeah, really. John Hagee should have been there with them.
Yeah.
All right, the First Crusade.
Well, you
when,
know, John Hagee married a Canaanite, you know.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it.
Yeah, see, the Mexicans got the Canaanite, you know, some of the Sephardim Jews, there were several boatloads of them, left Spain, and they went to Central America, and they mixed with the Indian tribes, and today almost all of the Mexicans have Jewish names, you know, but it's not of the tribe of Judah, they're Canaanite. And one of the names is Perez, you know, that's one of Judah's sons, you know.
Well, there's two so-called Spanish names that are absolutely Canaanite Jew names, and that's Perez and Mendez. And Perez, you know, is from a Hebrew word meaning to part or to divide, and that was the name of Perez. And then Mendez is actually the name of the Egyptian goat god. Did you know that?
No, I've heard the name of the – I never connected.
Oh, yeah. There's definitely a connection there. Mendez, when you see an Hispanic or a Latino named Mendez, you could know that he was named after the Egyptian goat god.
Well, they truly are goats.
Yes, they are, and the name fits.
But anyway, I thought I'd throw in what John Hagee said about it. So John Hagee's read a couple of history books somewhere as a line, but he's on the wrong side of the street when he reads it.
Right. Now the First Crusade was the most successful, right? I mean, it's the only one that established anything that lasted a while.
Well, if you want to call 9/10 of all the men that...
Yeah, I understand. They all died doing it, but it was... And that shows you how sad the whole tale of all the Crusades was.
Yeah, it was the briars and thorns and the wall, you know, that the Almighty put there to not let them get back.
Right, it wouldn't
they might get there and stay for a little while, but, you know, eventually they got kicked out.
Right.
And all these people today taking trips to Israel, you know, I think I would think twice before I would take a
think
trip.
Twice? There's no way I would want to give, if I had any money, I wouldn't want to spend it on those Jews in Palestine. That's crazy.
You know?
I wouldn't want to give them a dime. I wouldn't want to eat in their restaurants, sleep in their motels, buy souvenirs in their souvenir shop, pay admittance to anything. The hell with those Jews. I ain't spending a dime with them. That's just crazy. Christians go over there and give the Jews all their money, pay inflated prices for all that garbage.
Well, you know, he Raymond Capped a few years, you know, 25 years back. He got loads of people, and he took trips. And, of course, he would go to the British Isles and probably go there to that early church, you know, what's that called now? I can't think of the name of the place there. And then he'd go to different places around Britain, you know, proving that that they were in the tin business, you know, that Joseph of Arimathea was in the tin business and the people knew about it and various things. And then they would go on to different places in Europe, and then they would go on down into the Middle East. And I think they did go to Palestine, and then they would go on down to Egypt to the pyramids and stuff. And I often thought, you know, it'd been nice to take a trip, but, you know, I look back, you know, I wouldn't mind going to Europe, and I wouldn't mind going to, you know, to Britain and Europe, and maybe even Egypt to the pyramids, but I surely wouldn't, I don't think I'd want to go. I do think I'd even think twice about Egypt.
Well, you know, the Crusades got going based on, some books call it propaganda of Pope Urban, but some other books give the stories a lot of credence and say that the events actually happened. The Arab Muslims were actually killing and looting and raping and punishing Christians who went on pilgrimages to Jerusalem. And actually the Knights Templar was founded by Hugh of Pagens to guide and protect Christian religious pilgrims in 1120 AD.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. Back in those days, you didn't take off and just walk down the road.
No, there's no rule of law.
You stayed with a group, and you had a few people along that could fight. You know, if you get robbed or something like that, you didn't travel in the olden times. And you weren't safe until you left one city inside the wall till you got to the next city and got inside that wall.
Exactly. And then you weren't entirely safe, especially if you were a stranger. But
you better know who you're going to see.
Yeah, right. But you were in you know, the Greeks, they had strangers, people, sojourners from foreign lands were actually considered holy by the early Greeks, and they were never to be harmed. That they were never. It was a disgrace if a stranger got hurt in your city or in your land. It was considered a reproach to you. It was a disgrace to you.
Well, that'd be kind of nice to have people like that.
But the Arabs didn't care about anything. They'd rape you and your daughter. That they seem not to, and that's, you know, a commandment from Yahweh, that our people do that. Yeah, you know, the respect of sojourners, because we were sojourners in strange lands. But the Arabs don't have that that law written in their hearts, and they certainly aren't bound to obey Yahweh anyway. That they're wolves eat sheep. That's what they do.
Well, I kind of think that the hedge that the Almighty put to keep us from going back was the Turks.
Well, yeah, and in a way it probably was. And I'm sure the Arabs helped. You know, the Arabs actually...
Well, when I take all those people in class, see, there's a lot of people yet that are upholding the Arabs in the world today. And see, these Arabs has got the same, and Turks and all that, they've got the same satanic blood as Jews have.
Yes, they do. And, you know, just last night, Ronald Gardner did me a great favor and sent me this paper. And I put it on the front page of Christogenia last night.
What paper is that?
Human Immunology. It's a report. It's a scientific report from, it's a journal. It's a scholarly scientific journal called Human Immunology. The official journal of the American Society for Histocompatibility and Immunogenics. And I have the entire facsimile of the 21-page report on my website now, and it's entitled, the name of the report is entitled, The Origin of the Palestinians and Their Genetic Relatedness with Other Mediterranean Populations. And it goes on to say in the abstract, which is a summary of the report at the beginning, the genetic profile of Palestinians has for the first time been studied by using human leukocyte. I'm sorry, I got to blow this up for a minute. It's the print's real small unless you click on it. By using human leukocyte antigen gene variability and haplotypes, the comparison with other Mediterranean populations by using neighbor joining dendrograms and correspondence analysis reveal that Palestinians are genetically very close to Jews and other Middle East populations, including Turks, Lebanese, Egyptians, Armenians, and Iranians. Archaeological and genetic data support that both Jews and Palestinians came from the ancient Canaanites, who extensively mixed with Egyptians, Mesopotamians, and Anatolian peoples in ancient times. Now we know this. We know this to be true. Now, let me say that this report was retracted. And I'm going to read the retraction. Dear subscriber, regrettably, it has come to our attention that an article in a recent issue of Human Immunology, and it gives the volume, page numbers, and title, and the authors, included certain statements that the American Society of Histocompatibility and Immunogenetics, the editor-in-chief, and we as publisher found were entirely inappropriate for articles published in this journal. Some Jews complained, and threw a hissy fit, that they're not Canaanites and they're not related to Palestinians, and this journal backed down. I'll bet, well, I don't, $1 million if I had it, that's what probably happened.
That could be the only thing that did happen.
And it's on the front page of my site. If anybody wants this article, it's in 21.
I'll have to take a look at that.
You got to click. You could click on each page and save. You know, you'll be brought to the full size of the page and be able to read it because the print's real small. And you could save each one, and it's 21 files, and they're JPEG files. But it's a scholarly journal, and it exposes the Jews, and they didn't like it. So it has the retraction right on it. And
well, you know, it enforces what Christ said, you know, when they was accusing Christ of casting out Satan by Satan, you know. And Christ said that Satan was divided against himself. And today you've got the Arabs and you've got the Jews and they're divided.
Absolutely. And they are both Satan. They're both satanic.
Well, you know,
a lot of people on identity even want to embrace these Arabs simply because they're the enemies of the Jews. They don't understand history. They don't understand that the Arabs and the Jews have worked together against Christendom for 1,500 years or better, and it can turn, the tables can turn tomorrow. The Jews want us to hate the Arabs that are in the Near East. And at the same time, the Jewish-controlled media and the Jewish-controlled politically correct crowd wants us to embrace Arabs in our own homelands. That's just crazy.
They're on both sides of the fence.
The Jews are definitely on both sides of the fence, and any Christian that can't see that is a straight idiot.
Well, you know,
because while we're destroying the Arabs in Jewland, the Arabs are destroying our nations because of the Jews. I'm sorry, go on.
We really need to get back to Muhammad, you know. I wrote pretty lengthy in Watchman Teaching Letter Number 55, and I pointed out that Muhammad's mother was a Jew. Muhammad's scribe was a Jew.
Yes, I have Heinrich Gretz in front of me, and Heinrich Gretz doesn't go as far as calling Muhammad's mother a Jew. He actually makes this enigmatic statement, though, saying that Muhammad wasn't a true loyal son of Judah or something to that effect. But he does say that Muhammad surrounded himself with beautiful Jewish women, as if there could be such a thing. And he loves women, and you know, that's the basis for that 75 virgin religion or whatever they're up to now. And basically, you're right. Muhammad's scribe was a Jew, and Muhammad himself could not write. And the Jews did his writing for him.
Yeah, and they, it wasn't Muhammad that wrote the Quran. It was the Jews.
Right, it was the Jews that wrote the Quran. Muhammad couldn't write.
You know, I've got a book. It's what it is. It's a textbook history for Jews, and it's called The Story of the Jews. It was written by Rabbi Lee J. Levinger and his wife Emma Eckrich Levinger in 1928. And it was later rewritten by Harry Gersh. In Chapter 7, which is titled the Geonim Meet the Challenge of Islam, under the subheading, Mohammedan tries to win over the Jews, on page 84. There's one paragraph that says this: the Jews of Medina were defeated. Those who were not killed were exiled from Arabia. Then one by one, Mohammed picked off the independent, disunited Jewish fortresses and cities. But although he had little love for the Jews, he did not stir up hatred for them as a people. In fact, he took several Jewish women into his harem.
And Muhammad only came to hate the Jews because they wouldn't accept his new religion.
But later on, during the Turkish time, the Jews considered the Mohammedanism the golden age.
Right, absolutely. And they still consider that a golden age. They still talk about how wonderful that was and how advanced Islamic society was until the 11th or 12th.
And if anybody wants to, you know, if they'll go to my letter 55, they'll find it. I cite the history of the decline and fall of Rome by Edward Gibbons a couple times.
Right, and Edward Gibbons clearly wrote that Muhammad's mother was a Jewess.
Yeah, and then I don't have this book, but I had a lady that was sending me copies of pages of the book at a time, and it was Azog's Universal History, copyrighted 1902, volume 2, page 192. And I cited not only that, but some other pages, and it substantiates that Muhammad's mother was a Jew.
Al-Zog's History of the Church, yes, it does. And I remember you photocopied that page for me years ago and sent it to me.
Well, that's been a while ago since I wrote 55. It was November 2002 when I did
right. 55. I remember you sent me copy, you know, photostatic copies of the pages from Alzog and Gibbon.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
And
I might have the book here. I'm not certain. I know I couldn't find it, but it just kind of run to my mind. There was a lady at the time that was sending me data, and all I'd have to tell her that I'm looking for, you know, I could tell her I'm looking for some data on Muhammad, you know, and you know what his lineage is and all that type of thing, and she'd look around. If she had anything in her library, she'd send it to me.
Now there's a lot of, I've seen a lot of information that tells me that Arab merchants were hiring the Seljuk Turks to attack the Greeks and to run the Byzantines out of Anatolia and out of Syria. And that makes a lot of sense to me.
Uh-huh.
It actually makes perfect sense to me. That the Seljuk Turks were actually working as mercenaries in the employ of Arab merchants.
Well, you know, we got to be careful today because these same people, they think exactly as the Turks and the Arabs back in those days.
Right. They don't come to Europe and European cities and American cities as immigrants. They come as invaders.
Well, now they're coming as doctors. And
I'd hang myself before I went to a Muslim doctor. I don't care what the disease is. I'm not going to a Muslim doctor.
Yeah.
No way. I don't know if I want to go to an American doctor.
There's a case, you know, that that Ridpath, he documented that one of the Turkish emirs, when the Crusaders was there, come out to meet him, you know, and he's coming back from a victory someplace, and he offered him some fruit. And so he ate an apple, and the apple was poisoned.
Well, anybody that eats an apple from a serpent deserves to die anyway. I mean,
that's what
got us into this mess, isn't it?
See, when you go to an Arab or Turkish doctor, or, you know, a Muslim doctor, put it that way, that believes in Mohammedanism, he writes you out a prescription, that is a poisoned apple.
Yes, it is.
Because you can't trust them. Now, they had that attack over in Britain. See, no, that was, I think it was in Ireland. Or was it Scotland? I can't remember. They was going to blow up an airport, and they caught them before they did a lot of damage. But it turned out to be three Arab doctors. And they couldn't understand over there, well, why would a doctor who's trying to save lives go out there to try to take people's lives? Well, they had some poison apples, didn't they?
They don't understand it. These people don't think like we do. They don't think like they're going to become part of our society and make money and live nice lives.
They can't. They
think like they
can't be part of us. That's all there is to it.
Well, right. They can't be because they want to destroy us. It's innate. It's in their genetic fiber.
Well, you go back to Genesis 3:15, and that's where they started, whether they're Arab or whether they're Jew.
Well, that's why I just made the joke about the Arab, you know, the apple and the serpent.
Yeah.
That's what I was alluding to.
Well, it's strange that Turkish emir was really playing the part. He was offering an apple, right?
Yes, he was.
And Eve shouldn't have ate the apple. It was poison.
Well, the bottom line here is that our people were told that they couldn't go back to Palestine because Yahweh put a hedge there, Hosea 2:6, and all the Crusades were destined to fail.
You know, I think that should be, anybody reads that should be a warning. Don't take a trip to Palestine, under the present conditions.
Right, and by that you know that none of those people in Palestine are the people of God.
Well, they're a den of serpents over there is what they are.
Absolutely.
And to get to Israel, you got to go through parts of Arabia, you know, and I don't know just how, you know, some of them fly in and get there different ways, but whether you get into an area controlled by the Arabs or whether you get in an area controlled by the Jews, it's still serpent territory.
Yeah, there's still children of Cain. There's no doubt. They just have different religions. That's why when an Arab terrorist dresses up as a Jew and he walks right into a Jew restaurant, you can't tell them apart.
Well, you know, King George, you know, back when Palestine became a British protectorate after World War One, and right away when that was declared a British protectorate, you know, all the problems that was happening over there, well, they'd come into King George, here they're doing this and here they're doing that, and he got tired of hearing it, and he said, let them settle it by blood. And what he was saying, let them fight it out and kill each other and get it over with.
Right.
There's a place in the Bible that says that whatever's settled on earth is settled in heaven. And him making that proclamation, he started that process. And one day you look at the newspaper or television or whatever where you hear from, and you'll hear where some Jews killed a bunch of Arabs, and the next day you'll read where a bunch of Arabs or Palestinians had a suitcase bomb and went in and blowed up 70 or 80 Israelis, or I hate to even call them that name, you know, Canaanite Jews. The guy that put that in effect was King George when he made that statement. He says, let them settle it by blood. And I say, you know, let them settle blood by blood today.
Right.
And the bloodier it is, the better.
He knew that there was not going to ever be peace. And he knew the Jews didn't want peace. He knew that the Jews were blowing up Englishmen over there to get English out of there.
Well, they blew up that hotel.
The King David Hotel, right.
Yeah. No wonder he said that. I think if I was, you know, in his place, I'd have said the same thing, you know.
Absolutely. But I think that it just, I don't know. They should have just wiped them all out, but. You know, when the Jews were running England, and King George probably knew that, too. He inherited that mess, so what can you do?
Well, the...
run them all out of England, too.
The Israeli side has got a problem over there. The Arabs are outbreeding them. and they can never overcome, even though they kill them by the thousand, they can't kill them fast enough to keep them from outbreeding them.
No, and the you know, Jews have a very high rate of homosexuality amongst them, and a lot of them just don't have children anyway.
Well, the thing, most Jews don't want to go over there anyway. They know it's a hoax, and they want to stay here and be leeches here.
Yeah, well, we're a much fatter hog to be a tick on, aren't we? I mean, than Palestine. There's not much meat on the bones over there.
And it really burns me up every time I hear on, they'll be interviewing some senator or representative or something, and they'll say, Israel is our best ally, you know.
But they have moved an awful, they've moved a lot of our technology firms over there, you know.
Yeah.
Here. And they've done it under the guise of opening up subsidiaries of these firms over there. And the next thing you know, most of the firms over there. And they've opened up an awful lot of, you know, there's two companies, the two biggest companies that sell security for the firewalls and the routers on the internet that run the internet are both in Palestine, are both in Kyrgyzstan. They're both in Israel. And
I like that word, Kyrgyzstan.
Kyrgyzstan is the one that's
Kyrgyzstan.
Right. There's actually a great number of our biotech companies are now in Kyrgyzstan, and a great number of computer technology companies are over there, too.
You know, I wouldn't doubt it.
Software. They're big into software.
You know, I think you ought to go through that thing that you did last night explaining how Richard the Lionheart fits into Daniel's prophecy.
Well, it's just like you said, they were the Daniel 11. I'm not saying, I can't guarantee that this interpretation is correct, but it struck me because I was you know, knowing you wanted to talk about the Crusades, it struck me that, you know, doing studying for that, that first I never believed that Daniel 11, that the entire prophecy was contained in the struggle between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Because those wars, even though they were numerous, they're also rather minor on the grand scale of the, you know, where Yahweh's people are in the world at this time. And it struck me that it had to be wider in scale. Fowler admits that there is a Roman period and even a later post-Roman period in a Byzantine period from verse, he counts verses, in Daniel 11, he counts verses 36 through 39 as describing the Byzantine period, and verses 31 through 35 is describing the Roman period, but verses 4 or 5 all the way to 30 as describing the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, and I just don't see that. And even though, you know, what Eli presented last night, it came along, it did what Rand's writing did. It did make a lot of sense that this described the Syrian wars. I just think that some of the verses do not, some statements in some verses definitely do not describe the Syrian wars. And I think that this is on a much grander scale, that, like you said, this is the two horns of Daniel 7 and 8, that the imperial papacy and Mohammedism fighting it out. And I'm going to, when I get the chance, I'm going to try to study this in more depth. But it's a difficult study because you actually need all the translations in front of you first, because the King James is so bad. And the Septuagint is far from perfect in many places. But as far as I'm concerned, this one prophecy, and it's actually not just Richard the Lionhearted, it's a couple of verses, seem to fit the Crusades perfectly. And that's, the king of the north shall come and shall cast up a mountain, take the most sent cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand neither his chosen people. That sounds like the first Crusade to me. Neither shall there be any strength to withstand, but he that cometh shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in a glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. To me, that sounds like the first Crusade, and it describes the first Crusade. And it's nothing, it doesn't mean anything if one of the Seleucids is standing in Palestine, because they've ruled over it since the time of Alexander, so that's not special. But what would be special is if an Anglo-Saxon was standing in Palestine. And that's what happened during the Crusade, after the First Crusade, when a Latin feudal kingdom was established in Jerusalem, which only lasted a few decades. It didn't last very long. And then it goes on, he shall set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, the upright ones with him. Thus he shall do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her. That describes to me Richard the Lionheart, and that Richard Lionheart offered his sister Joan to Saladin, the de facto ruler of Palestine, the Egyptian Arab, and he offered his daughter to his brother in marriage.
Uh-huh.
But she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. And then it goes on, after this he shall turn his face to the isles, and he yet shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. And I think that's when King Henry threw him in jail. Henry threw Richard Lionheart in jail, kept him there for about 4 years, until Britain came up with a hefty ransom. And that's the raiser of taxes that stood in his place to raise that ransom. They actually had what they called a Saladin tithe in to pay for the Crusade in the first place. And then they had to raise more taxes to pay Henry V off to let their king out of jail. And then it says that he'll you know, turn to his own land, which he went back to Britain, but he didn't stay there. He went to France, to Normandy, which is where he was really from, because he was one of the Plantagenet kings that, you know, descended from William the Conqueror. He was the third Plantagenet king, and he actually ruled over Britain, but he was a Norman Frank. And it says, then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Now, the fort of his own land, he went back to France to defend his holdings in France, and he was killed there. And that describes Richard the Lionheart to a T. It can't describe anybody else. I'm sorry. So I don't know how the rest of this picture puzzle fits together, but I know that somehow it does, and I might try to take the time this winter to
figure
it out.
I doubt whether Daniel would have left out an important historical period like the Crusades out of his prophecy. And the one little horn is part of it.
Well, both little horns.
Well, in
because
the Crusades,
all these Crusades,
yeah.
You know, the Pope
one little horn fighting another little horn. The
Popes put them off to it. The Pope's the little horn of Daniel 7. And if Muslim Islam is the little horn of Daniel 8, you're right. It's one little horn fighting the other little horn. And that's how this, I think that's how Daniel chapter 11 has to be examined.
That isn't those little horns are, a lot of these in church entity, they only speak about one little horn and they think that's an antichrist, you know, off in the future sometime.
Right. But there's more than one little horn.
Yeah, there's more than one little horn there. And one of them is the Pope. And the other is Muhammad, and that's a real serious thing of Richard the Lionheart offering his sister to a Turk. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that's going on today. It was his sister, wasn't it?
Yes, his own sister. He wanted and actually Saladin was an Egyptian Arab. You know, he was an Arab that came to rule Egypt.
That's like some of the white parents today, you know, go find a Negro boyfriend and get married to him.
Yeah, just for the sake of peace.
Yeah.
Well, Richard wanted to give his sister to this mudball for the sake of access to Jerusalem. That's just incredible.
That's a hell of a price to pay, isn't it?
Yeah, well, my sister would be worth a lot more to me than this stinking city full of Arabs.
But you know, that wasn't the only race mixing that was going on down there.
Oh, no.
Ripchaff on the Crusaders, Volume 2, page 332, says this, another circumstance tending to undermine the foundation of the kingdom, which, you know, Jerusalem, in other words, was the rapid deterioration of the people of the West under the conditions of life in Syria. The resident Crusaders brought into communion the fellowship with the native Christians of the country, Syrians, Greeks, Armenians. It's race of Orientals destitute of the war. In other words, these aren't the type of people like us that becomes, you always battle axe and weapons of war.
Yeah, right. Well, Ridpas probably knew that in his spirit, but couldn't describe it scripturally.
Destitute of the warlike vigor of the Western pilgrims.
But, you know, there was still, I got to say, there was still a lot of white blood, and the Arabs are mixed. There's no doubt they're mixed.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt that most of them ain't descended from Cain and Canaan. But there's still a lot of white blood in all of these lands. Do you know what I mean? It hadn't been completely subsumed yet.
Well, it says besides the Muslim peasantry, remained in the villages and continued to cultivate the soil. After a lapse of a few years, these diverse races began to commingle, and a new type of population was produced, inheriting but little virtue from either line of parentage. These hybrid inhabitants were known by the name of Pullani, P-U-L-L-A-N-I, or Pullanians. A degenerate stock deduced from a bad cross under the influence of a baleful climate and diseased society. Well, I don't think the climate had anything to do with it, but I think he's describing it right when he says a degenerate stock.
Absolutely.
And so here's evidence that if Israel hadn't have been taken into Assyria, Assyria was white people pretty much at the time, and all those countries that they were taken, even the Babylonians, you know, were by and large white people, and but had they stayed over there and not be deported in the various deportations, this very same thing would have happened to them a long time ago.
Well, absolutely, and that's part of Yahweh's plan. You know, Yahweh knew that Satan wanted to destroy the race of Adam, and he was going to let it go so far. And he promised salvation to Israel. Now, what that meant, if you go back to the time of Jacob, to the patriarchs, you know, he's only one family in an entire white race that inhabits all the land of the Near East and Southern Europe and Northern Africa and Mesopotamia all the way to the Indus River Valley is white. But none of them are Israelites. None of them, except Jacob and his sons, right?
Yeah.
And there's a promise of preservation to Israel. And that the entire rest of our race is overrun. And the white people in the world now descended from Israel with some smatterings of those other white families mixed in with them because, I mean, they clearly intermarried and brought along other Adamic whites with them. But all of those other Adamic white nations lost their identity as nations. None of the white nations of today are the white nations of 2,500 years ago.
I would say
3,000 years ago.
You'd be hard-pressed to really find many Japhethites today.
Well, there's remnants of Greeks and Romans that are white. There's no doubt. But the rest of them are pretty much wiped out. Where the
there probably is still a few Japhethites around.
Well, in the Slavic, in the Western Slavs and the Southern Slavs, I imagine that there are some Japhethites or mostly Japhethites. I don't doubt that personally.
And of course, the men of Israel was allowed to take wives of Islam, you know, from the Japhethites and the Hamites, but a white woman wasn't allowed to take a husband because the original promise to Abraham was just to him and his seed. So to be under the covenant, you have to go through the male line.
Right. But,
and I think there's a lot of people don't realize that.
But nevertheless, all the race of Adam is going to be in resurrection.
Yeah, I agree with that.
All of the race of Adam does not have the special covenant relationship with Yahweh.
But the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you know, they're the chosen ones. They're the chosen ones out of Adam.
Absolutely.
And evidently the Almighty saw something in Adam that he didn't see and the others.
Well, of course, and the in Abraham that he didn't see any others, perhaps, but the promise of salvation that was given to Abraham meant it had nothing to do with heavenly salvation. It meant salvation here on this earth, because things are supposed to be on earth as they are in heaven. And Abraham's seed were the chosen people to carry on the will of Yahweh here on this earth. And that's something entirely different than the spiritual salvation that we're all to receive and the blessing of the resurrection.
Well, it'd surely be useless to try to convert an Arab today.
Well, of
or
course.
A Turk or something like that.
It's contrary to the word of Yahweh. Somebody of mixed race is a strange vine. Somebody of mixed race is a broken cistern.
And that's what that guy out in Idaho is doing, you know, that took over Sheldon Emery's. What's his name now that you wrote to him?
Dave Barley,
Dave
right.
Dave Barley, yeah.
Well, Pete Peters does the same thing. I mean, he's a serial Negro embracer. Dave Barley is in bed with Mark Glenn, and he has his head in the latrine. There's no doubt. He embraces Arabs and all sorts of aliens.
Well,
he's invited
Arabs to speak at his meetings in his church out there in Idaho. Well, that's surely out of place.
Well, yeah, I would think.
But there's others in the identity that's following his example.
Well, yes, they do, and I, you know, it's you can put all the information out there you want. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. That's a pretty good adage, and
I don't see any place along the line where Dave Barley ever changed his mind on the thing.
He's never going to change his mind. Dave Barley's not going to change his mind. He's going to look into the face of Yahshua Christ and deny him and tell him what the Bible says. I swear. That's the way I look at it. And Pete Peters is going to try to do the same thing. They'll be right there with John Hagee in the lake of fire.
Yeah, right. You know, I after studying the Crusades, I think everybody ought to get into that history. It's our history, and it isn't a very good history of us, and you know, it's kind of hanging out our dirty laundry, but it is part of our history, and I really believe it's important to know it. And I do think it joins in with Daniel's prophecy. And even Adam Clark made reference that passage. I think it wasn't the 11th chapter of Daniel there that fits in with the that period of time.
Oh, I don't have the Adam Clark reference.
Well, I found in there that even he, you know, like that Fowler, kind of connected it up to that period of time.
Right, and there's more than just the Richard Lionhearted passage that.
Well, he didn't connect that part up, but he connected it with the Turks and the Crusade period.
Yeah, there's more than that matches it up, and I'll be getting into it next week with Eli on the Christogenos program when we finish Daniel.
But, you know, it says that we're not going to understand Daniel until the end time.
Right, and I can't pretend to understand it now, half of it.
Yeah, but I think that, I really see that's a good probability that Richard, you know, I used to go to matinee shows on, way back, you know. My parents didn't like going to shows, but, you know, I went to them, and, you know, you got a nickel and a dime together, you could go for an afternoon, and they would have the Robin Hood, it might be part of that matinee, you know. They generally had a cowboy show, and then Robin Hood or, you know, stuff like that. But I remember him talking about Richard the Lionheart way back in those Robin Hood shows, and you know it amazes me that Robin, you know, not Robin Hood, but Richard the Lionheart, it might be part of Daniel's prophecy. I think there's a real good chance that you're right, you know.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I'll
it makes
I'll
a lot of sense to me, and I don't think that Daniel would write a whole bunch of stuff. And see, Daniel's prophecy goes clear up into where the Turks attack Constantinople, and that's around 1400. Well, that's 400 years past this. Well, why would he leave out the Crusade period?
Well, he wouldn't.
And,
or maybe he wouldn't. You
the
know,
Crusade,
we don't know.
The Crusade period would be more important, really, than when they destroyed Constantinople with those old brass cannons that they had shaped like a lion.
Yes.
And I don't think there's a lot of people realize that the Turks had lions back there. And they molded them to look just like a lion, and the cannonballs would come. You know, they had a little cover over it, and they take it off, of course, before they shot them, and it look the cannonballs come out the lion's mouth, and that's pretty well pictured in the book of Revelation, you know, and of course some of these people, they have real crazy ideas what they think that passage means, you know, but that cannon that they had is and this lion had a tail that went up his back, you know, and they would pour some kind of liquid that burned in that, and that fire would go on down and light the powder in the base of the cannon, and that cannonball would come out the lion's mouth, and that's what's described in the book of Revelation, and that's what broke the walls of Constantinople down so the Turks could take that.
Now this I want to what do you think about this Innocent III? This Pope,
Innocent III. I'm not sure.
He proclaimed three of these crusades. Three of these crusades were on him.
Uh huh. Okay.
Plus the Children's Crusade, and he was the reason for the crusade against the Waldenses and the Albigensians.
Well, I'd say him going after the Waldenses speaks bad for him right there.
And the Children's Crusade was on his watch.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
So you have three crusades, all on Innocent the Third's watch. The Fourth Crusade in 1202. The Fifth Crusade in 1218. The Children's Crusade in 1212. The Albigensians Crusade in 1208. We're all on his watch.
Well, it sounds to me like he was pretty wicked. And see, some Jews got in there as popes, you know. And I don't know whether he would be... It would be interesting to find whether... I don't know when the Medicis come along and the Borgias, but it'd be kind of interesting to know what his background was.
Yeah, yes, it would. Innocent III. That's probably something you might want to check out for your paper.
I think the most interesting person in the crusade was Frederick II. I think it was which pope was that that had Frederick II.
It was Gregory the Ninth that he had.
Yeah, that's the one, Gregory the Ninth. And there was a little war going on between the Pope and Frederick II. There, he had promised he'd go, and after 5 years, he didn't go. And the Pope decided to excommunicate him. And So Frederick decided, well, maybe you better go. And so he did, and he only just took a handful of his knights with him. I mean, the people saw him leaving, and, you know, how can he win anything with that few of men? But when he got down there, everything he put his hand to, he won one battle right after another.
Right, but he ultimately made a truce with the Sultan of Egypt.
Yeah, right. He must have been a kind of diplomatic, you know, on a lot of that stuff.
Who this history book I got calls El Camille, but his name means the camel. That's what his name means.
Oh, okay.
I read
the different things, you know, about camel, you know, and I.
Well, it's El Camille in the history book. It's E-L and then it's K-A-M-I-L.
The one they're just talking about camel, I know.
I don't
know
see how it
about.
Doesn't mean the camel. I mean, camel is
actually
an Arabic word.
I know the name of somebody, but, you know.
Camel is actually an Arabic and a Hebrew word. And the Greeks, you know, camelus. And that's where we got the word from. And it has to mean the camel. It can't mean anything else.
Uh-huh.
El Camille, the camel. And he's the Sultan of Egypt, is a camel, and he made a deal with this Frederick II, a 10-year truce.
Ten years.
The camel gave up Jerusalem for 10 years, you know, under the truce, and Nazareth and Bethlehem.
But he turned around and he went home, and, you know, things started going backwards as soon as he left.
Well, before he left, he crowned himself, Frederick crowned himself the king of Jerusalem.
Yeah, and see, he did like Napoleon did. The Pope, if it had been there, he'd have refused to crown him. In fact, the priest, you know, the legates or whatever of the Pope, they wouldn't crown him, so he had to put the crown on his own head.
Right.
Well, see, he did that before Napoleon did it.
Yes, he did. But he went back and had war with the Pope and kissed and made up with Gregory.
Yeah, he finally kissed his rear end.
In 1230.
Yeah.
And in 1244, Jerusalem was captured for the last time by the Muslims. There were two crusades after that, but by 1244 it was over. There was, you know, we never went back to the Middle East until the British, the British in World War One.
But what it shows me that he was German, and he had some German knights, and they were Yahweh's battle axe and weapons of war, and when they went over there, the heads rolled. As far as that goes, even Richard the Lionhearted, when he got in the battle, he made the heads roll. I mean, he had that quality of being always battle axe and weapons of war. But, you know, it doesn't uphold him for trying to give his sister to a Turk.
Yeah, I'm going to start calling him Richard the Race Mixer. The hell with that Lionhearted stuff. He that ran out with me. I'm sorry.
But anyway, you know, I think the Crusades prove that the Germans are good fighters, even though they lost a lot. You know, sometimes when they were outnumbered and stuff, I mean, they really come through some battles, you know.
Well, there's no doubt the Germans weren't good fighters. I mean, it's just their history. They weren't. Germany itself was never supposed to have any sovereignty. That's just the prophecies of Yahweh.
Mm-hmm. And I think the Crusades, you know, it may not prove a lot of things, but it does. The Germans, whenever they got in there, they were the best fighters among the Crusaders. And of course, Richard the Lionhearted, you know, he was probably a Saxon, and the Saxons were German.
He was a Norman Frank, but the Franks were German too, and so were the Normans. They were, we all fell out of the same tree.
Yeah,
we all came from the same rock cut out of the mountain.
Well, you know, there's 20 some, probably more than 20 German tribes. And a lot of people don't realize how many German tribes there are, and so they all have to be of Judah. That doesn't include the different ones that are of their Judah, like the Romans.
Absolutely.
The Lombards and the Suevi and the Alans and even the Vandals, you know, they were Germans.
Absolutely. The Vandals were German, the Goths were German, the Alans were Germans, and basically Josephus relates them directly to the Israelites at the dispersion. And I don't know how so many historians miss that. The only way they could miss that is if they just want to miss it. That's incredible. That's in that paper I wrote, that Classical Records of the Origins of the Scythians.
Mm-hmm.
Those citations.
Yeah, I remember typing out all those. I never thought when I was typing out those years ago, you know, for you, I knew I was going to put it in a brochure, you know, and circulate it with my mail, but I never dreamed that we'd have websites and that stuff would be going around the world. So I'm real happy about that.
Yeah, that's good. That's because that's where it's going. There's no doubt.
And you know, my prisoners is on my list. They're still sending and want those German series.
Oh yeah, that's good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, there's a lot of them, and
I should write part 7 someday.
Yeah,
I got so much on my plate. It's hard to get anything done.
Well, do you know anything else about the Crusaders that we ought to talk about, or?
Nah, it's getting pretty late. I wish we could have gotten into the Crusades a little deeper, but you know, you can only do so much in an hour and a half. And I
kind of wanted to explain to people how I got on the subject, and I thought it was kind of important to get in that word Gentile again, and I think. Maybe the listeners may have a better idea that term was corrupted, you know, between the time Jerome used the word in his Bible until the Middle English time when somebody gave it the meaning of non-Jew. And so somebody was misguided during that period. You know, you can see how the people didn't have their Bibles, you know, during that time, but somehow it got corrupted between the time of Jerome until our English Bibles was, and see that the English Bibles they just because Jerome used the term, they used the term. And nobody ever took the time to explain it. It was a Latin term.
Absolutely. And yeah, people, I don't know, it's not an English word. It doesn't belong in the English language.
I would recommend that anybody doesn't have a copy of the American Heritage Dictionary that has Indo-European roots in it. And I don't know whether they still sell that new in the bookstores or not. But, you know, they might have to look around to some used bookstores. But I think it's as important to have that dictionary as it is the Strong's Concordance.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know. If I made a list of books people should have, it'd be pretty long. It's important to get a grip on the, if you want to really study the Bible, you have to get a grip on the original languages.
And see, that gives you, even for a person that don't understand, you know, the Latin and the various languages, the Indo-European roots will even take you to a lot of things in Greek, you know. And it's like, I'll tell you, one of the things I learned that I like about it, and I learned it, Jim Wickstrom used to have some followers, and they was putting out videos, and of course they was talking about Christmas and so on. You know, I don't say anything against what, you know, I don't keep Christmas either. But they was saying that the term Noel, you know, in the Christmas song, you know, and they said it meant no God. Well, they was taking the English word no and the Hebrew word El, which means God, and putting it together and coming up with that, and Noel doesn't mean that.
Well, you'd have to be a real idiot to think something like that.
Well, you know, I was looking up under the word born, and I think that was the word, and it told me go to the appendix, told me where to go, and I went there, and it brought up the word Noel, and all the word Noel means born. So, you know, when they sing the Christmas carol, Noel, 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 it's born, born, born.
Right. There's a lot of scoffers that make up stories that fit their view of the world, and they'll take advantage of any little thing to twist something, and that's an example, that Noel means no God. You know, that's just ridiculous to think that the French in the Middle Ages would take an English word and a Hebrew word and put them together and make a song out of it. You know, like that.
And, well, the rest of what these people said, they were pretty good. And they recommended you go out and you look for old books, and the older books were better and all that. And they were right. And they put on a program, but they spoiled their presentation by saying that Noel meant no God, and it doesn't. And, you know, I bought that for a while, and I passed that on to other people. And I'm sorry now that I didn't look into that a long time ago.
Well, we can all make mistakes. The humble and wise man recognizes them and admits to them and corrects himself.
Well, I've sure made my mistake. There's one thing about when you make a mistake and you get burned a little bit, you don't make that mistake again. And I've made my share of mistakes, and I admit it. And if I find I've been wrong on something else, I'm going to change.
Yeah, and that's the the idea that and it's prevalent in identity that once somebody's wrong about something, whether they admit it or not, that they're no longer inspired by God. You can't possibly be wrong about anything, or you can't be a preacher or a teacher of anything.
They think that if they admit they're wrong on something, they lose all their credibility.
Right.
Well, if they're wrong on something and somebody finds out that they're wrong, they've lost their credibility without saying it.
Right. And basically, I think that this week I was able to force Scott Vaught to admit that he's an idiot. Or to make an idiot out of himself, because he did go translate Revelations 5:5, and somebody sent me his translation.
Yeah, I got that through the email too.
And he made a jerk out of himself translating, and he's supposed to be the
if he can't understand that in Greek, he can't understand the Paleo Hebrew either.
No, he's a liar.
I was down to some meetings where he was at, and I never remember him ever saying that a certain Hebrew word was a certain part of speech.
No, because he doesn't understand the parts of speech. And that's just an example of somebody who's wrong and who will twist anything in Scripture to avoid admitting that he was wrong about something.
That group down there, they seem to be a follower of Jeffers, you know, is from Arizona. And that Jeffers, he was passing all, you know, Jeffers was a Paul Basher, and he passed a whole bunch of bad stuff around. And I think there's where the problem lies, is in that, I forget what Jeffers' first name. Of course, Jeffers is dead a long time ago, and there's another guy pushing his stuff around the country. But if there's people out there that haven't come in contact with Jeffers' material, at least take some advice, you know, be careful.
Yeah, Jeffers was, I consider him to be a just plain fraud. He twisted the Dead Sea Scrolls up into an unrecognizable mess. And then he tries to say that John the Baptist is Christ and that he lived 100 years before he actually did. And he really, I don't know how people that contrive such ridiculous doctrines seem to thrive. It's incredible. But people love the lie. They love to buy into a lie.
Well, I can tell, you know, I sent in for his materials for a while. I just, and I ordered a few. It wasn't, didn't cost much of his stuff, you know. Just, I wanted to counter him on some of the things that he was, I never got around to do very much of it, but, I got some of that stuff through the mail. Well, then he put me on his mailing list, and I could tell by his mailing list he had a gift of gab to the women. So he's just like Satan. He's a deceiver. He goes after and he deceives women.
Yeah, that's there's a lot of guys like that.
And I could see why women would fall for what he's teaching.
Sweet talking, smooth words and pleasantries and deceptive language. And yeah, well, a lot of guys fall for it too, but there's a lot of guys that love to sweet talk women that they can't get anywhere with guys. Okay, I'm going to wrap this up. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, okay.
And, well, I'll be here again tomorrow night with Sword Brethren, 9 o'clock. We'll have, on Sword Brethren's Come Out of Her, we'll have Professor Kevin McDonald. And he wrote a book on the Frankfurt School and the corruption of Western civilization by the Marxist Jews of Columbia University. So we'll be discussing that tomorrow night. Okay, praise Yahweh, and it was great to have you, and I hope we can do it again sometime, Clifton.
Yeah, have a good night now.
Good night. Praise Yahweh. Mm-hmm.